Yesterday, Paramartha admitted that the first Buddhist book that he'd ever read or been influenced by was the Life of Milarepa. Where is he? Hi. Also, in our group, when we first met, there were at least three or four of us out of that group that had also first met Buddhism through Milarepa. So I just thought I'd do a quick survey to see how many of us actually had their first contact with Buddhism through Milarepa, through reading about Milarepa. How many? Just let's have a little show of hands. Three? Oh, there should have been more than that because there's more in our group. Oh, well, that completely ruins the whole picture. Okay, that surprises me. I thought it would be more, actually. I thought more people would have said that that had been their first introduction. Perhaps this is an issue of the 60s, because, the songs, there was an abridged Songs of Milarepa, which was published in the late 50s, I think, or early 60s, which was going around. And also there was Evans Vence's Life of Milarepa, which was around at that time. So they were, in fact, amongst the most available Buddhist books. But it was, in fact, the case with me. The first real contact I had, other than a book on Burmese Buddhism that my father had been given when he was in India during the Second World War, my first contact with a Buddhist, really, was with Milarepa, through reading the abridged Songs of Milarepa. And I was very, very strongly attracted by the life that he lived. I was strongly attracted by the sense of freedom that you got in the songs, the spaciousness, the kind of living in the mountains, the wandering from place to place, living in beautiful surroundings, you know, often talking about the beauty of the trees and the mountains and the rivers and the laughing monkeys and so on. And also, I was very impressed by this man that had gone off to live in the wilderness, into the wilds. Although I would never have expressed it in this way at that time, I think I was very strongly attracted by the renunciant lifestyle. Now, you know, I was a child of the 60s. We weren't exactly renunciant. But there was a strand of renunciation running through that period. The renunciation was to do with renunciation of the world as we found it, in a way. There was the post-war world of the 1950s and early 60s, which was very stable, very secure, and there was quite a strong reaction to that. It was boring, you know. Nobody really wanted that kind of life. The life that was on offer was not really something that was particularly attractive. We wanted to explore. It started with the Beats in the 50s and then went on to become a big kind of cultural movement in the 60s with the hippies and so on. So there was a definite sort of yearning for a different kind of life, a very strong yearning for a different kind of life, and a life that wasn't based on material security, on the sort of the things that our parents valued. So I think Milarepa, in a way, captured that. He was definitely an image of that spirit, and so a lot of people responded to him. There was also another side, I must say, for myself and for many other people, and there were quite strong worldly pulls. Not so much pulls for the kind of society into which we've been born, but I think for me, the pulls were, well, one could mainly say they were in the area of women and ambition. Those were the two kind of worldly pulls that I found. I was very, very interested in women, continued to be for many decades, exploring the whole subject with some degree of detail. I was also ambitious. I wanted to do something. I wanted to be known. I wanted, when I left this world, I wanted to have made my mark. Those I consider two very strong sort of worldly ambitions. But the spiritual life, I think, has been a gradual strengthening of that renunciant stimulus, let's call it that. There was the renunciant stimulus, and then there was the worldly stimulus. Gradually, the renunciant stimulus has been increased, and the worldly stimulus has lost its life, has lost its sort of vitality. I still find women very attractive, but I'm not so interested in getting involved with them these days. Also, every now and again, I feel the tug of ambition. You know, I feel like I want to be there out front. You know, I want to sort of do something and be known for doing something. But then, you know, I've moved to Gigaloka, which does suit me very well. It is my element. It's where I want to be. And it's not exactly a place where you can really fulfil ambition. It's there's not a lot to do there. So you can... one of the hardest things for me going to Gigaloka was not the lack of women. It was the feeling that I was moving out of the kind of... of becoming part of the mainstream of the movement. Do you know what I mean? Part of being a kind of well-known person within the movement. There was a very definite, strong feeling of abandoning that in going to Gigaloka. I also knew a bit about the Buddha in those early days as well, mainly from Hermann Hesse. Hermann Hesse? Hesse? And and although I was also attracted by the fact that the Buddha was a wanderer, you know, he was also a wanderer. He wandered in the forests. He was homeless. He was adventurous. But I wasn't interested in being a monk. I never wanted to be a monk. You know, monks don't have anything to do with women, which was kind of a major difficulty for me. So I wasn't interested in that. And I wasn't interested in religion. I was anti-religious. So I was kind of very, a very different sort of relationship with the Buddha. But Milarepa didn't seem to cause those problems. He wasn't a monk, he was an Anagarika. It wasn't even an Anagarika. He was just, wasn't anything actually. He'd never ordained at all. So he was basically, fundamentally, he was technically a layperson. And he wasn't religious. You know, you don't get the flavour of religion from Milarepa. You get something quite different. You get the kind of, an image of a very substantial man. A wild man, wild in the best possible sense, of a man that hasn't been tamed. He hasn't been domesticated. There's something extremely strong and vital and manly about him. He was unconventional. He rejected the conventions of his times, and I think, again, this was something one admired, you know, a rejection of the conventions to create something anew. Over time, I must say, I've come to appreciate the Buddha much more. And I can now see in a way that the Buddha represents a kind of a spiritual ideal that is somewhat broader than Milarepa. Milarepa, in a way, epitomises one particular aspect of the Buddha's being. He epitomises that renunciant aspect. But there are certain other characteristics of the Buddha, which we see in Milarepa, but they're not so strongly represented. Milarepa, in a way, really represents, I think, the renunciant. I mean, he, if you like, he is the image. He is the image of the renunciant, the uncompromising image of the renunciant. The Buddha, though, I think, was able to speak to a broader range of men and women. He could move much more easily amongst, you know, the wealthy, the powerful, ordinary men and women. Milarepa did that, of course. Although Milarepa lived in the wilds of the mountains, he would go to the villages and towns. He did communicate with people that lived in the villages and towns. He wasn't entirely isolated in his lifestyle. He engaged with others out of compassion and the need of food. But he didn't do it in a way to such an extent as the Buddha did. The Buddha's teaching, I think, was also rather broader it was more easily accessible to more people, perhaps, than was Milarepa's. So they both lived in the forest, in the mountains, in the wilderness. They both lived not far from villages and towns. They both had many disciples, both lay and renunciant. We should also, I think we should reflect that, in a way, if it hadn't have been for Gampopa and Rachumpa to some extent, we may never have heard of Milarepa. The Buddha didn't leave any written records, of course, either, but he left a lot of disciples to carry on his teaching. His teaching was sort of quite broadly disseminated. But really, the teaching of Milarepa only comes to us through these two people. Rachumpa brings us the life and focuses much on Milarepa's life and his teachings of Mahamudra. And Gampopa, who was one of the major disciples of Milarepa and also a disciple of Atisha, he presented Milarepa's teaching in a much more systematic form. I kind of, in my own mind, I make a little bit of a connection here between Bhante and Subhuti. Bhante's teachings, although they're clear, they're not systematic. He's not presented an overall systematic teaching. Subhuti has taken all of those teachings and he's systematized them. He's put them together in very clear systems. Now, I think that's a very necessary process for a teaching. It needs, if it's going to last, if it's going to build a tradition, it needs to be systematized. It needs to be expressed it needs to have a form that can be carried on for future generations. And this is what I think Gampopa did for Milarepa. He took that teaching and he gave it a form which has enabled to come down to us. So in a way, I think whenever we're studying Milarepa, we should also take a look at Gampopa. Gampopa is an important support to understanding Milarepa's teaching. Gampopa also established the monastic tradition. And a monastic tradition, again, has got a certain kind of form and structure, and so it can last through time. It can carry, it's got institutions that can carry a teaching on into the future. Milarepa and Gampopa never formed those, I'm not exactly sure that this is true actually, but I don't think that they ever formed a monastic tradition. Theirs was much more yogic tradition. And it did kind of last, I think, but I think probably because it had the support of the monastic tradition as well. So there is a limit, in a way, to the renunciant lifestyle. It doesn't necessarily take into account future generations. And often the renunciant is criticised for not acting out of compassion. However, given the distance in both physical distance from here to Tibet, the distance in time, 1,000 years, and the cultural difference, we still find that Milarepa is a strong influence on us today. He still speaks to us across that vast distance of space, time and culture. This is why I was hoping to have more of you put your hands up at the beginning. But even so, the fact that you're here and know about Milarepa, and I hope responding to him in some way, indicates that his influence is felt. His influence is now felt throughout the world, around the whole world, 1,000 years after his death. So even though he didn't leave any written records, even though he didn't leave any very specific systematized teachings, his influence has still spread and has been a support and encouragement to probably millions of people's spiritual practice. The renunciant life is of great value indeed. It is a part of the Buddhist tradition. It's there right from the beginning in the Buddha's life, and it's manifested by many, many of the great teachers throughout the tradition. Although the tradition itself is broader than that. There's the monastic traditions, there's the monastic lifestyles, there's the householder lifestyles. There is a much broader range of Buddhist lifestyle and practice than just the renunciant lifestyle. But the renunciant lifestyle seems to me to be an uncompromising statement, an expression of the Buddha's teaching in a very direct manner. One wonders, in fact, how many highly realized renunciants there may have been, of whom we've heard absolutely nothing. Do you know, in the forests of India and Southeast Asia, in China, in Japan, in Tibet, they may have been very, very great men and women, but we don't know anything about them. For example, Ryokan. We wouldn't have heard of Ryokan if it hadn't have been for Teishin, the young nun who wrote down his poetry and who sort of brought forward his work to a wider audience. He would have just disappeared into the forests. So it's occasionally worth realizing just, you know, who were these renunciants? Where were they? And what might they have done? However, if our tradition, if Buddhist tradition is to survive, it will need yogis, it will need renunciants, but it will also need monks. It will need those who live communally and who protect the Dharma, protect the teachings and transmit the teachings. And of course, it must be connected to those that are living within the world, within the culture at that time. Reginald Ray has been criticised, I know, in various ways, but his analysis of the Buddhist community into the forest renunciant, the monastic, and the householder seems to me to be an extremely valuable analysis, extremely valuable way of looking at the whole of the Buddhist tradition. It is, of course, possible that the outer lifestyle may not correspond to the inner spirit. It's possible, for example, that someone might be living the life of a renunciant, but just be a complete libertine. You know, just using his renunciant lifestyle as an excuse for, immoral and fattening behaviour. So it's we can't deny that possibility. The lifestyle itself is not enough. And it may, of course, also be that someone who seems to be thoroughly immersed in the worldly life, like Vimalakirti, is actually, in essence, is a very profound renunciant. So it's all complicated. It's very complicated. It's a complex question. Anyway, let's come back to Milarepa. Just a quick look at Milarepa's life as the exemplification of the renunciant lifestyle. Milarepa is very interesting in that he did not follow the Indian paradigm of the spiritual man. Usually in the Indian tradition, the man starts off as a prince or as someone from a wealthy background. So in the descriptions, a lot of the holy men of India, you find that they start off as princes. They start off having been fully immersed with a rich taste of the worldly life, which they then become disgusted with, disillusioned with, and they turn their backs on it and go to the forest. Well, that wasn't the case with Milarepa. Milarepa, as we heard last night, never tasted the good life. He tasted the bad life. He always had it tough. He never, ever, in the whole of his life, had the riches of the world, or the comforts of the world, or the delights of the world, or the pleasures of the world. Now, this is important because it means that since he gained liberation, you don't have to have the worldly benefits first. You don't have to do the world before you can reject it. It's possible to reject it before you've even had it. Yeah. Sometimes one finds people saying, well, yeah, renunciation's all very well, but I haven't really tasted the world yet. You know, there's a few more things I need to do to get fully disillusioned before I can go and live the renunciant life. Milarepa didn't do it, and Milarepa's our man, so we don't have to. We don't have to follow that line. He started out with deprivation, poverty, and abuse. And he developed, well, this isn't strictly traditional, but I'm going to say he developed resentment. Now, it's always his mother who's portrayed as driving him to his magical activities. But I kind of imagine that Milarepa must have had some of that himself as well. You know, if when you read the life story written by Rachunka, of course, who was, you know, his great disciple, you get the impression of a rather sort of sanitized Milarepa going through that evil phase. You know, it's almost as though he's this Milarepa here, this bright Milarepa, going through a bad year or two. But I think what I'd like to do is try and think, well, what must he have been like? Do you know? He's this young kid who's always been badly treated, whose mother's been sort of feeding him with negativity. And he goes off and learns magic in order to kill some people. Now that to me is a pretty dark character. I imagine him as being a somewhat dark and somewhat frightening character. You know, if you met him, it wouldn't be the later Milarepa you'd be meeting. It would be that early kind of rather black character. I remember a good friend of mine, when he first came along to the FWBO, he was entirely... Actually, I'm dressed in black tonight. And he was entirely dressed in black. He had long black hair. He had a big black beard. And he had these black eyes staring out from this little bit of white face here. And he had this sort of symbol hanging around his neck with this sort of kind of magical symbol on it. He was terrifying. He was terrifying. And he wasn't happy. You know, he was in quite a dark state. And I imagine Milarepa rather more like that than somebody sort of really, really beautiful, but, as I say, having a bad day. He did all that he could to injure those who had injured him. And according to the way that people saw it, he succeeded. He managed to get his own back. But then he began to see the evilness of it. So he'd already, in a way, even through his... What I'm getting at here is that even through his psychology, I think Milarepa had gone away from the world. He'd rejected the world. Do you know? He didn't reject the world out of being satiated by it. He rejected it because he hated it. He wanted to be away from it. Yeah? But at the same time, he realized that there was something evil and unskillful in that perspective. And this is when he went to Marpa. And this is where Marpa performed the transformation. Now, Milarepa didn't then think, once he'd sort of, as it were, been resolved from his psychological rejection of the world, he didn't go back to it. I suppose in a way he could have done, couldn't he? He could have gone to Marpa the therapist, he could have got perfectly all right, could have gone back to his village, got a nice job, settled down, you know, been a good citizen forever after. But he didn't. He'd something about it had taken him beyond wanting to go back into the world. It's a very interesting process, I find this. It's like Milarepa's renunciation was not out of... I suppose satiation's the word. It's not being satisfied and wanting more. His rejection of the world was one of somewhat sort of more negative attitude first. However, once he's seen the light from Marpa, through Marpa, he carries on staying in the mountains. Marpa tells him to stay in the mountains. And gradually... he transforms things. At first, we read in the songs, when Milarepa was in the mountains, he found it extremely painful. But gradually, he transformed this to discover more and more joy of being there. And he became to appreciate more and more clearly the conditions that he was living under and how that they would enable him to deepen his practice and to experience the happiness that arose from his practice. So almost like Milarepa skipped the world. He never got involved with it. His only involvement was a negative one, and then he went into a much more positive state of being, of experiencing the positivity, the joy of being separated from it. So Milarepa's life was transformed from one of great evil and suffering to one of great good and great joy and happiness, even though he always lived in absolute poverty and great material discomfort. Although Milarepa was a historical figure, that seems quite clear, he's become an archetype of the Buddhist renunciant. This, I think, is his importance. He appeals to the renunciant within. You don't hear a lot about it. There's no books about that, is there? There ought to be. A book about, you know, contacting, playing with the renunciant within. Because there is something in us that wants to just be free from all of this, that wants to just sort of, you know, not have worldly responsibilities, to be able to just sort of deepen our experience of the Dharma. And Milarepa touches that. Also, we're very fortunate because we have a very full literature about his life and teaching, which is always uncompromising. So this image of the renunciant can be very, very richly embellished. It's a delightful, very rich. You can explore the songs for decades. You can always find new little angles and new little pieces hidden away in the songs. Sometimes little one or two liners in there just sort of shed another light on this incredible man. It's very easy to bring Milarepa alive in the imagination. And once he's alive in our imaginations, either individually or collectively, then he becomes a real force in the world for the good of his devotees and also for other people. So let's have a look at his attitudes towards the worldly life, his teachings on renunciation. I'm going to read you five songs that he sings to a couple. Milarepa has been in the mountains. He's been meditating at a cave called the Great Light Cave. So let's say he's been having a pretty spacious experience. He's in very, very positive state. And one day he goes down to the village for some alms. He meets a married couple who have no children. And they get in conversation with him. And they offer him a strip of land and a house so that he can have somewhere to live. Very generous, very kind of them, you know, bringing them in. So what does Milarepa say to this very kind offer? I have no need of these things, and I'll tell you why. Home and land at first seem pleasant, but they are like a rasp filing away one's body, word and mind. You know, a rasp just a little bit at a time, gradually, gradually. How toilsome ploughing and digging and going to the office, it doesn't say that, but, do you know what I mean, can become. And when the seeds that you never, and when the seeds you planted never sprout, when your expectations never come to anything, you've worked for naught. In the end, it becomes a land of misery, desolate and unprotected. A place of hungry spirits and haunting ghosts. When I think of the warehouse for storing sinful deeds, it gnaws at my heart. In such a prison of transiency, I will not stay. I have no wish to join your family. Sounds a bit hard, doesn't it? I haven't heard anything yet. So the couple say, oh, don't talk like that. There's good things about this life. For example, you can have a lovely, lovely bride, someone to suit, you know, lovely lady from the village to suit your taste. Milarepa sang. At first, the lady is like a heavenly angel. We all know this. This is true. The more you look at her, the more you want to gaze. Middle-aged, she becomes a demon with corpse's eyes. You say one word to her, and she shouts back too. She pulls your hair and hits your knee. You strike her with your staff, but back she throws the ladle. At life's end, she becomes an old cow with no teeth. Her angry eyes burn with a devilish fire, penetrating deep into your heart. I keep away from women to avoid fights and quarrels. For the young bride you mentioned, I have no appetite. I love this next line. The husband then says, "Dear Lama, it is true." But what about a son? You know, when you get old, you need a son to care for you. Milarepa says, "In youth, a son is like the Prince of Heaven. You love him so much that the passion is hard to bear. In middle age, he becomes a ruthless creditor to whom you give all, but he wants still more. Driven from the house are his own parents. Invited in is his beloved, charming lady. His father calls, but he will not answer. His mother cries out, but he will not listen. Then the neighbours take advantage, spreading lies and rumours. Thus I learned that one's child oft becomes one's enemy. Bearing this in mind, I renounce the fetters of samsara. For sons and nephews, I have no appetite." Yeah. I thought quite a lot about this verse over the years, and in recent years I've actually seen in my relationship with my own father, I've seen some of these things. Not that I think I'm a ruthless creditor to him, but he thinks I am. You know, it's like what this is talking about is the psychology of the father. The way that your attitude towards your child changes as he gets older, and more especially as you get older. When you start to lose your own, your own strength and vitality as you get older, and you see your son's strength and vitality, then it's very difficult to take, very difficult to really accept and come to terms with that. And I think this is what it's talking about. It's talking about the pleasure that you get from the young son is one side of it. But also, as you get older, you expect a lot to come from that relationship. But perhaps it doesn't quite do it for one reason or another. I think that's what it's talking about. It's talking about upset expectations. And they say, "Well, then, maybe a daughter? How about a daughter?" Milarepa sang, "In youth, a daughter is like a smiling heavenly angel." This is true. I've got so many friends, fathers of young daughters, and they're absolutely gaga over their daughters. More gaga than they are over their sons, I think. But, you know, they've got hopes for their sons, but their daughters, beautiful. "She's more attractive than precious than our jewels. In the middle age, she's good for nothing. Before her father, she openly carries things away. She pilfers secretly behind her mother's back. If her parents do not praise her and satisfy her wants, they will suffer from her bitterness and temper. In the end, she becomes red-faced and wields a sword. At her best, she may serve and devote herself to others. At her worst, she will bring mishaps and disaster. Woman is always a troublemaker. Bearing this in mind, one should avoid irretrievable misfortunes. For women, the primary source of suffering, I have no appetite." It's quite strong, isn't it? For women, the primary source of suffering. I just challenge you to maybe look at your own life and see what has been the primary source of suffering. I say no more. Okay, no sons and daughters, but at least one needs kind of, you know, a social environment. At least you need friends, relatives, and, you know, you need some kind of social connection, surely, they say. Life would be much too miserable and helpless without friends and relatives. Isn't that so? Milarepa replied, "At first, when a man meets his relatives, he's happy and joyful. With enthusiasm, he serves, entertains, and talks to them. Later, they share his meat and wine. He offers them something to them once. They may reciprocate. In the end, they cause anger, craving, and bitterness. They are a fountain of regret and unhappiness. With this in mind, I renounce pleasant and sociable friends. For kinsmen and neighbours, I have no appetite." Well, a couple now say, "Well, okay, but well, we've got an enormous amount of property. Would you like some of our property and our money?"
No, gosh.
Milarepa then burst into his final song. "Wealth at first leads to self-enjoyment, making other people envious. However much one has, one never feels that it's enough. Until one is bound by the miser's demon. It is then hard to spend it on virtuous deeds." This is a bit of a confession. I found this to be the case. When I lived in the States, I kept all my money in my back pocket. It usually amounted to anything up to $20. And so $100 was pretty good. I felt wealthy. When I came to Padmaloka, I got my first month's support, and it was 100 quid. I had 100 quid. I felt really, that was really good. And I managed to save a little bit as well. And I owned a bank account and everything, and got, you know, 140 quid, something like that. But I didn't like it to go below 100. You know, I wanted to keep that 100. Later on, my parents started giving me some money. And I gradually built up money, so I had £1,000 in the bank. And I didn't like it to go below 1,000. Yeah. And then my mum left me some money when she died, and a little over 10,000. So then I had 10,000 in the bank, and I didn't like it to go below 10,000. Do you see what I mean? This is how it goes. You can exist on very little. But as soon as you've got a bit, you start to want to kind of hold on to it. You start to grab onto it. One eventually becomes bound by the miser's demon. It's then hard to spend it on virtuous deeds. Wealth provokes enemies and stirs up ghosts. One works hard to gather riches which others will spend. In the end, one struggles for life and death. To amass wealth and money invites enemies. So I renounce the delusions of samsara. To become the victim of deceitful evils, I have no appetite. So this, I think, is a statement of Milarepa's position. It's uncompromisingly stated. I think there's a sense of humour there. I think we need, you know, I can tell by the atmosphere in the room, it goes quite deep, doesn't it? But nonetheless, there is an atmosphere. You know, he's not being kind of fire and brimstone about it. He's stating things actually as they really are. He can seem very hard. He can seem very uncompromising. But our attachments are very strong. Our attachments are very strong, and they're supported from so many different angles in the world. So much of the world supports those particular attachments. Mm-hmm. So the voice against it, the counterpoint to that, has to be very strong indeed, if it's going to make any effect whatsoever. There's very little counterpoint to it. There's very little contradiction of the values of the world. But it's needed, and Milarepa is the one who can give it. Asanga says that desire arises from focus on the pleasurable qualities of an object. So to free ourselves from the bonds of desire, we need to take a more rounded view of the object of attachment. So, since we normally insist on only seeing the pleasurable, we need to be reminded of the painful, even if it's done in a rather sort of caricaturish sort of way. We need to be reminded of the painful side of things in order to see things as they really are. Gampopa, again, systematising Milarepa's teaching, says that the translators of the Dual Ornament Liberation have translated renouncing the world by saying that it means letting go of the busy world of social intercourse and all its manifestations. They call it social busyness. So renunciation of the world means to abandon the complex web of social interactions and all its traps and distractions, so that we can see beyond this into a brighter and more pure level of existence. Gampopa says, the essential characteristic of the world is to be distracted through the company of one's children, spouse, acquaintances, or possessions. Attachment to material things, such as food, clothing, comfort, and so on. And attachment to reputation and respect, such as other people's praise. Because of such attachments, one cannot get away from the world. For us, I think we'd also have to include comfort, material comfort, entertainment, and the possession of material goods. They become a much bigger factor in this industrial society, consumerist society, than they ever would have been in pre-industrial, pre-consumerist societies. So these seem to be, the ones we covered, seem to be the main areas of attachment. But when he's talking to those that follow the spiritual life, either as monks or yogis, Milarepa often talks about two other things as well. He talks about the abandonment of pride, particularly the desire for status and reputation. He also mentions abandoning pride in scholastic knowledge or in meditative accomplishments. I read a little section here. When you solicit the deep teachings of the practice, do not long for your learning, nor to become a scholar. Else worldly actions and desires will dominate. Then in this very life will be thrown away. Be humble and modest, and you will find your way. When the various meditation experiences come to you, do not be proud and anxious to tell people, else you will disturb the devas and dakinis. Meditate without distractions, and you will find the way. When you accompany your guru, do not look upon his merits or demerits, else you will find mountains of faults. Only with faith and loyalty will you find your way. When you attend holy meetings with brothers and sisters in the Dharma, do not think of heading the row, else you will arouse both hate and craving, and offend against the precepts. Adjust yourselves, understand each other, and you will find your way. When you beg for alms in the village, do not use the Dharma for deceit or exploitation, else you will force yourself ever down the lower path. Be honest and sincere, and you will find your way. There's a 5th century Christian monk called Cassian, and I discovered this quote from him. He says, the monk should flee women and bishops. I love that. He warned then against the diabolical temptation of seeking clerical office out of a desire to bring spiritual help to others. I think that's worth mulling over, isn't it? It's that, you know, one can move away from the ambitions of the world and take on the ambitions of the spiritual life, which is even more dangerous. It's a diabolical temptation. Because if one is fulfilling one's ambitions, which are going to get in the way of your spiritual life, through supposedly working for the spiritual life, then there's a problem. So one needs to be particularly careful of that kind of thing. Beyond all of this, of course, there is renunciation of the self. There is the renunciation of the five skandhas and so on. But I'm not going to go into that anymore today. Why should we do it? Why should we practice renunciation? You know, it's a hassle, it's difficult, it's unpleasant at times. Why should we do it? It's often very difficult to hear the teaching on renunciation. I remember I was talking about renunciation on a retreat in Montana once, and a young woman got up, burst into tears, and ran out of the room. She just couldn't bear the thought of having to give up anything. It later turned out that previously her boyfriend had dumped her, and I think she was quite emotional about all this sort of thing. But it was, but she really could not face the idea of giving anything up. Sometimes when one's enthusing about the value of renunciation, about the joys of renunciation, one can actually get quite a negative reaction. Now, sometimes I think this is okay, because of course we're attached to our attachments. And if somebody's telling us, you know, even in the kindest and gentlest possible way, that we should consider letting go of them, well, we can get a bit kind of bullshit, can't we? You know, what are you telling me to leave the things I'm attached to for? But I think there's something else that goes on in the West, which is even more pernicious. In Western religious life, there is a strong emphasis on sacrifice, on actual sacrifices in the Jewish, in Judaism. But there's also, in Christianity, of course, there's the idea of the sacrifice of the Lamb of God for the guilt of the world. So there's this idea that one has to give up things as a sacrifice in order to appease the guilt of things that you're supposed to have done wrong, the sin that you're meant to have been born with, actually. So this whole idea of giving up, of sacrifice, I think slightly perverts our approach to renunciation. Renunciation is associated with sacrifice and with guilt, whereas this is completely alien to Buddhism. In Buddhism, there's no such thing as sacrifice. I mean, sacrifice was strongly rejected by the Buddha. In Buddhism, renunciation is associated with letting go of lesser pleasures for greater pleasures. It's associated with letting go of suffering. We renounce things because they cause us suffering. We don't renounce things out of sacrifice for sins that we were supposed to have done. And I think this Christian area is really quite dark. It's quite a sort of, it's quite a deep and dark area. And even though we might have rejected Christianity, we were still brought up within that culture. And sometimes these things rest deeply in us, so that when there's talk of renunciation, it starts to stir some of those old ways of relating to things. So as I say, Buddhism has got nothing of this idea of sacrifice to appease guilt. You don't renounce things in order to punish yourself for unskillful things that you've done. It's a completely alien attitude. The teaching of Karma Vipaka makes this quite clear. But, as I said, conditioned views go quite deep. I said I'd put too much in here, didn't I? It's said in Christianity that you should give until it hurts. Perhaps a Buddhist equivalent to that would be give until you cannot stand the bliss any longer. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says this: even though a noble disciple has seen clearly as it actually is with proper wisdom how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, as long as he still does not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, he may still be attracted to sensual pleasures. In other words, you go beyond sensual pleasures because you've discovered something which is more blissful, which is more pleasurable. The Buddha went on to say that this was exactly his experience before he became enlightened. He could only practice renunciation on the basis of the experience of more pleasurable states of contentment and insight and so on. Letting go of the world can seem very unattractive. It can even seem rather bleak, a rather bleak prospect. So the Buddha reminds us that the reasons for us letting go of worldly pleasures is for greater pleasures. The rapture and pleasure of dhyana, or something even more peaceful than that, by which, of course, he's referring to the bliss of insight, of enlightenment. Think of the case of Nanda, who'd renounced his beautiful young wife. He was finding it difficult. What did the Buddha say? He didn't say, you must, get rid of her, forget her, she's evil, you've got to put her behind you, you've got to sacrifice her for the spiritual life. No, what he did was he took Nanda to the heaven of the 33, I think it was, and showed him the nymphs that serve the gods of that realm, who were far, far more beautiful than his human lady. He then became inspired to want to get to that realm so that he could have such nymphs serving him. The Buddha showed the higher pleasures of meditation. He showed beauty, contentment, refinement, delicacy, which is the results of the meditation rather than the undoubted pleasurable experience of the human wife, human lady. Milarepa says that living in solitude is self-imprisonment if one practice not the instruction of the oral transmission. You could say that renunciation is simply self-torture if one does not practice the Dharma. Renunciation is practice to improve our experience, to stop doing things that are painful. Even though we may willfully disregard the painful aspects of some of those things that give us pleasure. Yeah? Getting a wide enough perspective so that we can see both the pain and the pleasure of what we do and then, stop doing it because of the pain. It's giving up activities that give rise to suffering. It's giving up those things that get in the way of even greater pleasures. Generally speaking, I think we can say that the Buddhist spiritual life is about giving up pleasure for the sake of happiness, which is a much deeper, much more profound pleasure. In particular, we renounce the pleasures of the Karmaloka, the pleasures of the senses, for the happiness of Dhyana, the Rupaloka, for the happiness of the experiences we get in meditation. Happiness of higher states of consciousness. And by this, I don't mean sort of fancy mystical states. I mean things like profound, deep contentment, the experience of deep contentment, the experience of peace, finally being at peace, tranquility, of joy, of bliss, of ecstasy, of love, of compassion, of beauty. These are the sort of experiences that one can have that are not related to the senses. I'll be saying more about these in a couple of days. But these are the things, these are the rewards in a way from pulling ourselves away from engagement, total engagement with the world of the senses. Just a few, couple more minutes. Yeah. The joys of the renunciant life. Well, what are they? Well, first of all, just freedom from desire is itself pleasurable. I have one little experience of this at Gihaloka, walking from the toilet one day back to my hut. I realised I didn't want anything. I didn't want to do anything. I was just quite happy to be walking along that path. And I realised that non-desire was itself extremely pleasurable. It's not that desire caused you problems or that desire could mean that you could enjoy things. actual non-desire, the experience of not wanting anything, was an extremely pleasurable experience, a very happy experience. There are pleasures from just the simple life, you know, chopping wood and carrying water, just sort of doing a few simple odd jobs around the house in a very, very simple way. Living in a simple hut like Royakan did. Shantideva, rather poetically, after a long passage in which Shantideva is sort of exhaustively and exhaustingly been pointing out all the shocking, the graphic terms, the failures of the world, he then says, abandoning sensual desires, one should thus recoil from sensual desires and cultivate delight in solitude, in tranquil woodlands, empty of contention and strife, on peaceful rock surfaces, cooled by the fresh sandal balm of the moon's rays. Stretching wide as palaces, the fortunate pace, fanned by the silent, gentle forest breezes as they contemplate for the well-being of others. Passing what time one pleases, anywhere, in an empty dwelling, at the foot of a tree, or in caves, free from exhaustion of safeguarding a household. One lives as he pleases, free from care. One's conduct and dwelling are one's choice, bound to none. One enjoys that happiness and contentment which even for a king is hard to find. Milarepa abandoned comfort and companionship of his friends for the delights of the mountains, for the companionship of the devas and the angels. Just two readings. Some people have visited him and said, God, this is a terrible place you live in. It's really kind of cold and frightening and awful. What do you think of it? He said, this is a delightful place, a place of hills and forests. In the mountain meadows, flowers bloom. In the woods, dance the swaying trees. For monkeys, it is a playground. Birds sing tunefully. Bees fly and buzz. From day until night, the rainbows come and go. In summer and winter falls the sweet rain, and mist and fog roll up in fall and spring. At such a pleasant place in solitude, I, Milarepa, happily abide, meditating on the void illuminating mind. So he just loved the simple, the land that he was in, you know, the country that he was in. He enjoyed the mountains, he enjoyed the forests, enjoyed the animals, enjoyed the flowers. Not only that, because that's still quite material, isn't it? He used to enjoy the company of the devas and the angels. I like to call them angels, devas. And he says, this is in a later song, late last night, close to midnight, five lovely maids came here. They vowed to raise the Bodhi mind, offering wish-fulfilling accomplishments, and then they disappeared. Tonight, while the clear moon shines over the serene earth, you five charming maidens, gay and skittish, come once more. The silk scarves round your lovely bodies sway and flutter. Your jewels sparkle in the light. You have been conjured to perfection, enchanting and beautiful. At the goddess leader's call, the proud devas and angels of the eight divisions have come with you, filling the sky. They all offer me delicious food and play such charming tunes. Since you have asked for the utmost truth and final teachings, you should heed most carefully and give your attention. I'm going to be saying more about this in a couple of days' time. What are these angels? Are they these nymphs? Are they real or are they not real? Whatever they are, they correspond to an experience, a very real experience. This is what's important. They're images of a very real experience. It's an experience that's not only visual, but uses all of the subtle senses, not the physical senses, but the subtle senses. He doesn't mention the perfume of the nymphs, but nymphs wear beautiful perfume, better than anything you can buy in Paris. They have beautiful sounding voices. They have gentle touch. They feel good. They touch all of the senses. So we're talking here about sort of experiences coming from, not from the physical, the real core senses, but from the senses of the imagination, in which these beings are very real. In fact, more real sometimes than the experiences of the sense world. But even these lovely maidens have to be given up. They have to be abandoned. And what happens when you abandon these lovely maidens is you meet the Dakinis. And the Dakinis are even more beautiful. They're so beautiful, they're terrifying. Beauty has gone beyond pretty. Beauty has gone into the region of terror. The Dakinis live in cremation grounds. In other words, they live in the grounds where the ultimate sacrifice is made, where one gives up one's body. But if you go to the cremation grounds, it says in the tantric tradition, and Milarepa did this, if you go there, then you meet the Dakinis. The Dakinis are beyond beauty. They are ecstatic. They're completely naked. They're completely open. There's nothing. They hold on to nothing. They dance in the sky. They fly through the sky. There's nothing to hold them down. They're free. They're totally, utterly, and completely free. And it's the freedom of renunciation that introduces us to the Dakinis. They're emotionally full. It's not a freedom that's kind of dead. Renunciation doesn't lead to a kind of a dullness. It leads to a vitality, an increased vitality, a wildness. The wildness that we see in Milarepa is because he has the Dakinis. He's with the Dakinis. Dakinis are not human women. Dakinis are the reward of renunciation. As one renounces more and more, then the Dakinis will come, and they will come. They're promised to come, and they will come. In the end, Milarepa was taken off by the Dakinis. He was taken off to the pure land of the Dakinis, disappeared up into the sky, taken away by large numbers of Dakinis. So this again is showing that, again, right at the end, he was doing the ultimate renunciation, the renunciation of the whole world completely, totally, and utterly, and being reborn in the Dakini Pure Land. So that's what renunciation is all about. And maybe some of us would like to follow Milarepa to the land of the Dakinis.